How Social Justice, Art, and Literature Harms Actual Social Justice, Part 2. In Part 1, we looked at the bottom-up instincts that gave social justice fallacies fuel, and the common Moulton Bailey arguments social justice devotees use to stifle discourse and lump you in with the worst people in the world for minor infractions. The toys that need to be taken away first before we can get into the history of how these ideas developed and a deeper critique of their pretenses. Indeed, many of the social justice sympathetic are good people taking arguments purely and having their goodwill used against them. If you criticize BLM, the company, people ask if you think Black Lives Matter at all, but the company itself is run by proclaimed Marxists, advocating for what has little to do with the plights of black people. Many share stories on Gaza online from pages with hammer and sickle icons. We have to be wary of how we're being weaponized for a cause that uses another as battering ram. The best way to do this is to know where ideas come from and the context in which they arose. The social justice maxims that emerged out of post-classical studies has difficult prose often mistaken for scientism. I don't agree with the conservative position that it is all nonsense, it has to be criticized accurately. The issue is that people don't feel allowed to criticize it on campus. So I aim to provide companion without the biased priming from most professors. At a higher end gallery dominated by such ideas, it can feel like the pieces are deliberately nihilistic. I classify this broadly as a flight from representation. Much of these developments happened over the past century, but the major move was made around the end of the Enlightenment, a period of unparalleled scientific progress. As a species that operated in religious belief predominantly, with every scientific discovery, more ancient beliefs were disproven. Intellectuals could see religion slipping away and pivoted to protect God or faith, usually by marring reason. Immanuel Kant would make a decisive move. Where once we naively assumed our senses had direct access to reality and we could define the objective beyond the subjective, Kant draws the line between to say noumenal reality is closed off, that our subjective experience colors readings in infinite ways. At best, we have facts contingent to the calculations used to determine them. 2 plus 2 only equals 4 because we nominally created the 2s and 4s that don't exist in reality. Truth is socialized and contingent to linguistics, even scientific truths. This move protects God from being disproven, but made reason's final resolve a matter of faith, feeling, then, elevated to a new significance. What was of interest to Kant's aesthetics would be purer pleasures beyond socialization. He termed this the sublime, the reminders of mortality or natural beauties. The sublime became a staple in Romanticism. It was also a reaction to industrialism, with labor increasingly replaced by technology. What is our function then, if not machine producers? So Romanticism glorified the natural and human, but the feelings on the rapidly changing world were not always positive. Loss of faith in God and growing distrust in our faculties means reality was now a swirl of confusion for many. Perhaps it's best we didn't represent it in the beautiful Renaissance forms. The poet Philip Larkin aptly says, "Irresponsible exploitations of technique is a contradiction of human life as we know it. If we can't be conclusive about anything, a crisis in a meaningful existence loomed." Nietzsche predicted what he called the death of God. Not that a literal deity had died, but that the belief in an objective foundation for morality and truth was collapsing. This belief was at the center of how we lived. Even scientists begin because they believe a better result will come from their discoveries. If all we had was our subjective feelings, then why should I play by other people's rules? Here are Manet's light studies of the ruined cathedral as it appeared to his gaze. Now even the once sacrosanct church plugged into your perspective rather than you into it. John Dewey predicted a rise in narcissism with artists as the world industrialized and the artist's work was less integrated with society and they feel less mandated to gratify the audience. The artist then gallivants on their separateness and exaggerates eccentricity for actualization, according to Dewey. This prediction began to ring true. Marcel Duchamp's bride stripped bare by her bachelors even, a parody of scientific inventions, anti-art without discernible function, according to his notes, here depicts a bride undressing herself and a bunch of bachelors trapped below with no way of getting to her, so they take out frustrations through masturbation. Self-gratifying symbolized the increasing tilt to narcissism. Modernist paintings like Kirchner's self-portrait, depicting himself as a soldier returning home from the war, even though he served as a driver and never actually fought. In amputating his hands, this was to martyr the artist as a soldier who could no longer serve. Such solipsism was prevalent with the architects at the time, audaciously referring to themselves as master builders holding the keys to the cosmopolitan utopia. They believed in plain design without ornamentation, which was seen as a bourgeois luxury wasting labor. Many of their buildings were unbuildable, and a few that were proven by studies to elicit negative effects on emotional well-being. So a wipeout of representation had been planted. I like to think of the definitive turn from modernism to postmodernism as this moment from Rauschenberg, buying a de Kooning whose attention he felt jealous of. He erased away at it and left a blank canvas, embodying Ihab Hassan's description of postmodernism as the vast will to unmaking. By this point, modernism had resulted in catastrophes, world wars, the atom bombs, and all sorts of human rights atrocities. Impositions and reality yielded disaster. Adorno says, there can be no poetry after Auschwitz. To the intelligentsia, culture was now confirmed to be a disease. Thus, realism, in its attempts at depicting reality, was now relegated as a lower form of art. If we can't trust our own reality, then how can we trust a painter in their depiction of reality? Thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image, from Exodus 24, is often relayed. That to represent is to deceive nefariously. Human frailties will make what we depict perverse, like how depicting gods relegates the higher to the profane and low. We must cease trusting our language skills. It is appropriate that postmodernism was considered the critique not of Catholic religion, but Catholic feeling, that is, the trust in anything linguistic. David Lubin's book, Analyzing Realism in Art and Literature, An Act of Portrayal, is a play on the words act of betrayal. Further, art skills are seen as aligned with a level of privilege, so we must de-skill art. Thus began this will to moral purity. Ad Reinhardt, another blank canvas painter, took much pride in his pure, abstract, non-objective, timeless, spaceless, changeless, relationless, disinterested painting, declaring a rival at the ultimate or last paintings. He then painted only black paintings as he sought perfection every time. You could say that there's nothing left to be painted. But for critics like Rosalind Krauss, this was a fallacy yet. These works were still paintings, continuation of medium with a lineage in culture. True purity was in disposing the canvas entirely. This reductionism reached a crescendo with Andy Warhol's Brillo boxes, reducing art to placing found objects to communicate an idea. Thus, art theorist Arthur Danto declared this the end of art officially, that art had realized it was only ideas now. Skepticism in language has now become outright distaste. R.V. Young aptly describes this as the war on the word. It was a war on social constructionism at its absolute root. Influential psychoanalyst Jacques Lacan would reduce even thoughts to deception, that thoughts are mere stand-ins for the real. Even if you declare thought on your own state, that state is fleeting by the time of the words, and the words used are nominal. You are not sad, you are not anything, there is no you that language can refer to, only symbols that we grant meaning. Furthermore, Roland Barthes claims in The Death of the Author that the author is a mere conduit for their social conditioning and thus cannot claim to know more about their art than its audience. Text can mean whatever the reader says. All readers are now authors. What critic Michael Fried called theatricality in art, writerly constructions, was now rubbished. Jacques Derrida famously advocates it for deconstruction, to oppose the meaning of language, to rescue those oppressed by its nature. Derrida had a partial point. Language does privilege certain binaries over others superfluously. But this extends into believing all categorizing is hostile. Since language is understood in binaries, we should lean on the opposite meaning in all propositions to reverse oppression from the ground up. Deconstruction can be thought of as a means of uncivilizing in all forms of meaning making. Art, with an existing language in beauty and affect, was to be unraveled, such as in Joseph Kosoff's text description invoking the idea of an image. He rallied, being an artist now means to question the nature of art, to reduce art to ideas. Thus, with art now just being ideas, artists are also philosophers, praising Duchamp for being a philosopher. We were never to return to the old language in painting, echoing Rousseau's argument that art makes us love our slavery by making us civilized. Civilization represses, even a sentiment like love is loaded. Love as constructed valued restraint in society, particularly for women, monogamy, holding off till marriage, and, for a time, only the heterosexual was a valid love. So in the name of emancipation, decorum was eviscerated. Work now maximized discomfort. The comic opera in Berlin's adaptation of a Mozart classic deliberately shocked for lurid sex and fetish, and you're the problem if you found it deviant. To transgress was to emancipate. Anything breaking the established was thus moralistic. Adorno called for narrative joisance, deliberately creating discomfort. Krauss advocated for counter-type art against art's conventions. So Marcel Brodfeier rewrote Baudelaire's La Beauté in a book that decimates poetic structure through reordering, crossing out, and making indecipherable, a poem that dared to glorify beauty. Postmodernism then led the way for critical theory, which uses postmodern iconoclasm to allow bias against fact as an embedded tactic. I am going to make the vocabulary I favor look attractive. Whilst things like race and gender are also believed to be constructs, they are treated as real and have real-world dynamics, so if we use language at all, it should be in service of political punching up. In Kruger's text Sloganeering Without Finesse, you see the fallacies from part 1. Judy Chicago's Dinner Table, meant to be a celebration of women, drew new essentialist lines by making them sex organs, in the guise of dissociative feminism, as well as, of course, it literally being the dinner table being made. Calling all iconoclasm activism aside, this landscape leaves room for the vaguely moralistic deconstructionist practice to be used as a shield for mere foulness. Defecation in cans. I'm not proud of showing you some of these pieces, but there are pieces that I won't even show you because reference is bad enough. Paul McCarthy's sculptures of people in intercourse with animals and the Chapman Brothers' children with face anuses, and your disgust only shows that you've been brainwashed. The liberation of gay people and women's sexual freedom is a good goal, of course, but this goes overboard by aligning the justified with the inappropriate. Of our constructs, ideas like age limits or aversiveness to incest shouldn't be the first targets. We can have sensible discussions about moral constructionism so to have better morals without aligning insensibility with minorities, but it was increasingly being aligned. Queer theorists would call their brand of deconstruction queering. To undefine, to queer is to disrupt normativity. Queering, used alongside the death of the author, reinterprets all texts as being homoerotic. The juvenile insults you hear in school, calling all things gay, are academically attested at the cost of wholesome male friendships now, less the stereotype that gay people make it their personality. Sarah Ahmed advocated for killjoy feminism, of dissociating from social norms by leaning into unpleasantness and toxic disagreeableness, that women's studies should be a virus infesting society. Perhaps I'm trapped in hegemony for thinking of the gay and trans scholars who detest what's been cultivated as queering, who do enjoy refined culture and want to see themselves in it without being aligned with dysfunction. Same for women who have faced long enough stereotyping with irrationality and underhanded gossip. At worst, this mindset led to cohorts defending Jaak Unterweger, an Austrian serial killer and rapist. When he started writing poetry in prison, people declared him a Kantian genius for his trespassing morality, and thus, his was the only real poetry. However much you believe such theories' pretenses, when rules go out the window, this is what it leaves room for. We often say we don't like rules when really we just can't follow them. What one chooses to dismantle then says a lot about them. So I think many of these artists and critics are driven by a hatred of art, that their admonishing of art is guise for the hatred they hold. Listen to how they speak about art. Roger Taylor, in his claim that art promotes bourgeois ideology, compares it to a cancer. Duchamp, that the painter was considered stupid. I wanted to be intelligent. Malevich states that it is now impossible to paint the fat ass of Venus, advocating for burning museums. Nikki de Saint-Phalle's Venus de Milo, a semi-performance piece with a plaster on chicken wire version of the classic Beauty filled with bags of red paint, was fired at by Saint-Phalle with actual bullets. One of the most cynical is, of course, Sherry Levine's photograph of a photograph originally taken by Walker Evans. Levine wanted to undermine Evans's authorship and critique capitalism. Critics lauded the added value of her female identity. Her photo of the photo actually sold for $3 million, and she sold copies of the photo for $6,000 each. Speaking to Jed Pearl's idea of laissez-faire aesthetics, that openness for interpretation and anything being art now means anything can be commodified and patented, so long as theory is used. De-skilling makes it easier for those already rich to profit regardless of intention. Marcel Brodfeyer, an anti-capitalist artist, put a TV in a gallery and tried copywriting everything shown on it, including Charlie Chaplin reruns. Yves Klein staged an exhibition charging visitors to enter an empty room, effectively paying himself to not make art. The incentive structure is especially a factor with critics, who have a responsibility of literacy to provide context. But with the death of the author, Barthes wanted to make a god of every reader, so critics may say whatever they like to feel closer to an artist. Literary criticism becomes poetry without the need for lyrical prowess, like Peter Seltz flippantly likening this Rothko to the Annunciation. Rothko himself hated this interpretation, but intention is discarded to justify wild claims. Michael Fried likens this Courbet to castration separation anxiety, that to hide the deer's genitals speaks to Corbett's deep-seated toxic masculinity, so deep-seated that it might as well not be there at all. This claim is justified with the declaration that the genitals being in the shadows, what's imaginary for the viewer, is more important than the real. How utterly convenient. In Lubin's analyzing of Sargent's Daughters of Edward Darley Boyd, he compares the girls with Alice from Wonderland and Nora from Dollhouse. Regardless of whether Sargent had Carroll novels or the Ibsen drama in mind, Alice and Nora are part of the cultural landscape determining our present-day interpretive horizon. A lot of words to say that there's no historical justification for print. Lubin also speaks of the doll here as placed to reflect Sargent's patriarchal imprisoning of the daughters. Sexuality. That she protects her genital zone reflects how deeply sexualized she is. An act of repression this painting must achieve in order to abide by an ideology of sexual innocence. Lubin also delights in his wordplay with boy as like the French word boy for box, that the patriarchy boxes the girls in, and I'm not making this up, that the capitalized letter B is symbolically a male organ, whilst the lowercase is the female. This kind of thing isn't rare. Bell Hooks is a critical race scholar whose name is all in lowercase for similarly deconstructive reasons. Lucy Irigaray takes symbolic readings regarding E equals MC squared as a sexist equation and that it privileges the speed of light over other speeds. Poetic license is pervasive. And conveniently, if science is just a construct, then we can make irrational claims. It isn't just art where idiocy runs riot in service of politics. Funding and publishing for research strongly favors critical theory beliefs. There was the Grievance Study scandal where three professors submitted bogus papers to journals on critical theory to determine whether they would pass review. They wrote papers like one where they claimed to look at dog behaviors as evidence of rape culture in human males, another which was Hitler's Mein Kampf with the Nazi references replaced with feminist terms. A shocking amount were set to be published until they reviewed the prank. So long as the politics were good, we can dispense with proof. You hear about published dubious studies all the time too. There was one about how height differences in the sexes was down to the patriarchy. The Who Are You Here to See study showed that museums from America and Europe conspicuously lacked non-Americans and non-Europeans. Shock. There's also the practice of research justice, the forwarding of minority citations over others. An example is when Christy Dotson cited Gayatri Spivak for epistemic violence when Spivak cited Foucault first. Spivak, a non-European woman, was considered better for the cause. I wanted to show a gulf of examples so you didn't think I was picking out fringes. Pushback is met with hostility. In 2018, art students nationwide, fed up with the narrative, put up "It's okay to paint" signs and were promptly told the full lot. Trying to roll back decades of artistic evolution by non-white and non-male artists, and in doing so, tacitly support state-sponsored terror, police brutality against unarmed black men, and the ongoing genocide of indigenous peoples. There's a sense that the landscape refuses to change regardless of fact. The painters were called deluded for their signs, but a total of three painters have won Turner Prizes this millennium. Social justice devotees are less rebels than the Empire now. Art that does what has already been done is praised as though it's the first time it is done. Marina Abramovich's The Artist Is Here, where she sat still for days, was arguably less impressive than Chris Burden in 1975, where he stayed in this tiny ceiling crevice for 22 days, keeping himself alive on just celery juice. There are plenty of examples like this that nobody ever brings up. And since these pieces are predicated on their political edge, we can assess whether they succeed by seeing if they speak to the marginalized successfully. And all signs point to no. Sociologist Pierre Bourdieu wrote in Distinction that the working classes still prefer realism, whilst the avant-garde pieces are preferred by the rich, who purchased them to signal that they're not just in the financial elite but in the intellectual too, to dismiss those who don't get it as mere Philistines who lack expensive degrees to help them get it is absurdly backwards. Since the end of the Second World War, there's been much progress, even if not always linear. But we don't even have to agree on whether the world has improved since Auschwitz to criticize the dumber social justice theories without being cast as bigots. Ignorance shields us from learning and allows maintaining preferred narratives. Duchamp gets to play philosopher without being philosophically learned. Abramovich gets to play social scientist without being trained in psychology. We as artists can substitute skills for unhelpful postures. Ignorance is at the heart of stepping on other toes, even internally. There are justified accusations that thinkers desire to be the one with the term, even if someone else's would have sufficed. They're also always signaling signaling the end of some movement to pioneer the next, and we can notice they're self-serving even if they can't. Foucault hates positing truth claims, but one of his few investments with the real world was to protest for the abolishing of the age of consent. What one denigrates says much. Theorists are not safe from the fallacies in part one. They just use more words. That they've written so much in service of justifying inertia means young students have ample resource to intellectualize their own freezing in time. Let's look at some pathways. If you want to call someone a Nazi, Adorno has an authoritarian personality scale measuring fascism in behaviors as low register as manners and respect for authority. For inertia, Deleuze and Guattari's brand of psychological care, the anti-Oedipus, blames all turmoil on society and relieves the patient from acting voluntarily to improve, even encouraging schizophrenia to resist social norms, as illness is a mere problematic construct. Same in fat studies, one may abhor doctors for fat phobia if they suggest you lose weight, and switch to those who understand that fatness is a mere construct. Those who can't stand debate have Marcuse's repressive toleration, that free speech isn't truly free because right-wingers get to win debates, so we should censor them to allow true free speech to occur. Those who want to desecrate heterosexual love have Dworkin and McKinnon's equating of all heterosexual intercourse as rape of the female. The female has no true right to consent in the patriarchy. Even if they say they consent, they are not to be believed. Or do we just want inconvenient knowledge to be disproven on sight? Baudrillard may be of service here. Writing on reality being mere representations, even going so far as to say that the Gulf War was a spectacle that didn't happen, we can widen the margins until others doubt reality and cannot rely on the words you didn't want to hear. If it's as simple as not wanting to ever be wrong, there's a myriad to use. Derrida's here for duty. If I were to advance any thesis whatsoever, that in itself would be a fault, but I advance no thesis and so cannot be faulted. Young people often conjure such rhetoric anyway, so it's dangerous when they read their own thoughts with more approval or pyrotechnics. We can stunt growth and escape into prompts never to meet reality, but reality still gets affected. The Gulf War happened, anti-Oedipus can prolong suffering needlessly, and fat studies will get people killed. Just because we don't know about the world doesn't mean nothing else happens in it. Science moves regardless of being reduced to contingency, it still yielded penicillin and saved lives. Art too has objective, scientifically attested elements that we neglect in favor of slave morality. Our dislodging from reality has lost a man on the streets and made the world an uglier place. The poet Octavio Paz was spot on by saying, "Today modern art is beginning to lose its powers of negation, critique. For some years now, its rejections have been ritual repetitions, rebellion has turned into procedure, and criticism into rhetoric." He said that in 1974. Academia and art has frozen in time, and students are hapless to the same without a canon. Michael Sugra speaks of the importance of learning philosophy in order from the ancients to the moderns to the post-classics, priming for stability so we can dislocate with more agency if we choose to. In our reorganizing for optics, we misplace what the past actually is. We look at the historical museums and fault them for not reflecting today's demographics. Sadly, women were not allowed into academies for periods, and textbooks have to reflect that. What we can aim for is for everyone to learn effective art skills today. That begins by respecting what has been, and we can't do that if we alter it. Destroying an imperfect past cannot build the future, but we can glean it for their boons for a better future, to draw out the universal from the political. What theory supposes is that we have to see ourselves in media to thrive, but we're teaching people to look purely at group markers close-mindedly. Socrates said, "Strong minds discuss ideas, average minds discuss events, and weak minds discuss people." Where once the beauty of a landscape painting warmed our hearts with the recognition that we ourselves came from nature, thus our finding it beautiful consoled us through our ties with the beautiful. Today, the gaze compels finding the ugly. Aptly, the Greeks had this word, paideia, referring to both a humanities education and upbringing. Cultural education is equated to the raising of a child. To be literate is to grow up and develop into a true individual and have yardsticks for cultural involvement. This is echoed by T.S. Eliot, who wrote that historical literacy allows one to be a greater poet and artist. Likewise, social construction construction cannot ignore material reality. As Robert Hughes says, the architect's moral charter includes the duty to work with the real world and its inherent content. Memory is reality. Where social justice art is most wrong is that we aren't just what we are when we are at our worst and reduced to nothing. Human beings are also what we can be. Like the saying, man is a tool-making animal. We are a unique animal for being able to extend neural pathways into tools. Pilots can feel the turbulence on wings of planes, for instance. Culture is constructed, but human uniqueness is to construct, and the highest of all constructions is the artistic and beautiful. Language, if nominal to begin with, grows beautiful through refinement and continuity, and it becomes a part of us. Whilst beauty may never be fixed, it is an idea that emerges in all cultures. Contrary to postmodernism's narrative, we still sought it at our lowest. The Renaissance saw large-scale wars, disease, and poverty. Late Gothics produced glorious art after the Black Death. Psychologist Viktor Frankl, who was himself imprisoned in Auschwitz, relates how the more prison life became more intense, the more prisoners appreciated art and sunrises like never before. Prisoners even smuggled musical instruments in to make music. The appeal to meaninglessness unravels exactly what the likes of Frankl used to cope with such horrors. So to end then, I'd like to emphasize just how life-giving beauty was to Frankl. Should I perhaps try to explain for you with some hackneyed phrase how and why experiencing beauty can make life meaningful? I prefer to confine myself to the following thought experiment. Imagine that you are sitting in a concert hall listening to your favorite symphony, and your favorite bar of the symphony resound in your ears, and you are so moved by the music that it sends shivers down your spine. And now imagine that it would be possible for someone to ask you in this moment whether your life has meaning. I believe you would agree with me if I declared that in this case, you would only be able to give one answer, and it would go something like, it would have been worth it to have lived for this moment alone.